welcome to episode 139 of the Cricket Her Weekly.
Hang on, Raf. Before we get started, could you just open your email, please, and click yes to the email that I've sent you, please?
What am I agreeing to?
Well, Raf, this is Cricket Her 2.0, so we're going to be extremely hardcore and talk about women's cricket 70 hours a week.
Don't we already do that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. As you were, then. Carry on.
Okay. Right, we've had a big bit of news this week. They've announced the new England coach, which is very exciting. And it turned out that it was one of the John Lewis's.
But which one, Raf?
Which one? We don't know. No, we do know.
It was like, John Lewis, obviously.
It's the one who hasn't been working with them as an assistant coach, but has previously worked with the England men's team as the bowling coach, I believe. Anyway, we don't really know very much about him, so we're acknowledging the announcement, but we are hoping to get to interview him in the next few days and to actually talk next week a bit more when we know something about him and his vision for the team and why he applied for the job and all of that malarkey. So, here's the thing. If you've got any questions for John Lewis, the one who's been made the England coach, not the other one, who we probably won't be interviewing. If you do have any questions, then why not drop them in and we'll see if we can pose them to him. I don't know if we're allowed to do that, but we can try.
Okay.
So, in further news this week, another bit of exciting news, in relation to the 100. Sid, there's going to be a draft. And how it's going to work, as far as I can actually understand it, is that initially, each of the eight teams is going to be able to retain four players, and then there's going to be a kind of draft phase where some other players go into the draft and the teams get to pick, and it's going to happen at the same time as the men's draft.
Yeah, it's all a bit complicated and confusing, and I get the impression that what's happened here is that they've realised that there are actually a load of issues with a draft, particularly in a system where, you know, not everybody is anything like a full-time professional. Mm. So they've kind of created a draft with a load of caveats on it. So the first caveat, as you said, is that there are going to be like a load of players, 32 players, basically, that they are going to be picked before the draft, where the teams get to retain those players. Now, that is a positive in terms of the way the teams are set up, because I think that it is important for the fans to be able to see some consistency in the way the team is set up year after year and for their favourite players to be retained. Fans don't like it when their favourite players get to move somewhere else. So that's a positive. And then we've got a kind of some players then in the draft, but we've also then got another load of players that all of the semi-professional players are not going to be part of the draft process. They're going to carry on being selected via the sort of, you know, backroom methods that we've currently seen, where, you know, someone talks to you or calls you up or sends you a text message and says, do you want to play? So, yeah. Is it going to work? Well, it is going to allow some redistribution of players. There's no doubt about that,
What we haven't said is that the way that the draft will work is that Welsh Fire, who were bottom last time, will get to pick first, and then it will be the table from last year upended, and so Oval Invincibles will pick last. Sorry to interrupt, you see.
Yeah, absolutely. So what that means is that any players that aren't being retained from last year, the Welsh Fire will get the top choice of all those players.
Yeah.
What's going to happen then is, you know, is perhaps the most interesting question, Raf, because, you know, we are going to see then some players go somewhere they don't want to go.
Yeah,
and that's going to be a big question that, you know, I guess that the ECB are kind of saying to the players, well, if you want to be involved in this process, you have to be prepared to go anywhere. But I just wonder if, particularly in the case of some of the overseas players, if we'll see players just go, well, no, I'm not, sorry, bye. Or, you know, I'm already making X from my Australia contract. I'm already going to go and play in the women's IPL where I got an invitation to go and play, and that's going to pay me probably more than I'm going to earn from the 100. I don't want to go to X city. I don't want to play with Y coach.
Or, you know, these other players as well, because there are players in women's cricket. We don't talk about this very much, and I'm not gonna like elucidate on it particularly. But there are players who don't get on with each other, as there are in any walk of life, in any profession. And so to actually remove that autonomy from players and kind of say, and this is kind of, it's been happening in the men's game since franchise cricket was a thing, right? Because they've had the draft from the get-go. But for women's cricket, this is a new thing for you to not have that choice, for you to basically, if you go into the system, then you could end up anywhere. And so, as you say, yeah, it's kind of taking a bit of that autonomy away. And it's possible that players might walk away at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I would not be massively surprised if what ultimately happens is that the Welsh Fire pick players in the draft who then withdraw from the process at, after the draft. They just go, at the end of the day, no, I'm not actually going to go. And then Welsh Fire wind up having to pick new players from the few that are remaining that weren't even part of that draft process. So I'm just sceptical.
There'll surely be some kind of contractual obligation that if you enter the draft, you have to play unless you've got an injury or something.
Well, but then they're just going to go, well, I'm injured.
Okay.
I'm tired.
You're very cynical, Sid.
Well, it's just,
we've not seen it before in women's cricket. And I have to say, like, I know we've talked about the kind of pros and cons of a draft before, but now that it's actually come along, the more I think about it, the more I really don't like it. And the more I just think it's a kind of attempt to mimic the men's game and what they've done in the men's game. And actually, for our game, why do we need to mimic it? It's confusing. I don't believe that it's accessible for the fans. We have spent like an hour over the last couple of days since the news came out trying to work out what the ins and outs are and how it's going to work. If you're a casual fan, you're not going to, you are going to find that really difficult to pick up, this kind of this multi-stage process. You're going to go, oh, well, I'm going to watch the draft because I really want to know who my favourite player is going to be playing for this year. And then either they've already been picked or they're not even in the draft at all, potentially.
Or they get picked for a team that's not your favourite team.
Well,
and then you
yeah,
get cross
there
and
is that. That's obviously always a risk, but I think it's confusing. I think it's a bit half-assed, and I have to say I'm not a massive fan of it.
Okay, so the jury's out on that one.
There is this thing, though, that the teams have got a right-to-match card that they can use during the draft as well, which adds another complicating factor. I don't think they have this in the men's version. So if a team picks a player who didn't play for them in 2022, their previous team can re-sign them as long as they have a vacant slot in their team at that salary band. So it's like a kind of a trump card, if you like.
Yeah, it's a knockout, if you remember that. You probably don't because you're not old enough.
I've seen footage.
It's like, yes, they're playing their joker.
Didn't they have a royal family one? A
they
royal
did.
Family, it's a knockout.
Yeah, we don't talk about that, though.
Okay, we do not speak of such things.
But it's like, yes, Northern Superchargers are playing their joker now. That means that they can trade X for Y if they have three spots and £2,000 remaining in their... Yeah.
See, this is what I mean. And you tweeted the rules about the 100, didn't you? The 100 draft. You said, for anyone confused, it's quite simple. Smiths are wild, Georges are high, and Smales count double. Easy.
Well, there you go.
So, yes, all a bit complicated. There's been a couple of announcements as well that kind of came out at the same time as the draft that aren't really linked to the draft but are interesting. They've abolished overseas wildcards. So, last year, each team had four overseas instead of three. One of them was a kind of wildcard pick, which for most of the teams didn't play. But obviously at the Invincibles, Susie Bates ended up playing a lot compared with Danae van Niekerk. And men's and women's salaries are both staying the same as well.
Yeah. Now, I wonder if these two are related, Raf, because the overseas wildcards, obviously by not having them, you're saving a chunk of money. You're probably, over the men's and women's competition, you're probably saving a couple of £100,000 in salaries. And, you know, this... Clearly, we were always aware that the next year was going to be tight. We were surprised when the ECB went ahead with additional contracts in the regional system. We said at the time that that was a surprise just purely from the fact that it's going to be a really tough year economically in this country for the next year. But the ECB did that. But obviously, at that point, they're going, well, you know, guys, we have to draw a line somewhere and we can't afford to, you know, increase those salaries. But, Raf, it maybe is a little bit of a missed opportunity, do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I feel a bit disappointed by this because I think, given that they were going to tell all the men that their salaries were going to be frozen anyway, it was actually a real opportunity to then go, okay, well, we're going to raise the women's salaries, and then that's a chance to go further down this path of narrowing the salary disparity, which is still enormous. And actually, I'm a bit disappointed by that, because I think that that really is something that they could easily have done, given that they were freezing the men's salaries anyway. And, you know, we've talked about them not wanting to reduce the men's salaries in order to pay the women more. But, well, if you're going to freeze the men's salaries, then that's a chance to, if you are really committed to equal pay, which they say they are, then, you know, just, yeah, as you say, it feels like a missed opportunity anyway. Okay, there's been a couple of really positive pieces of news for women's cricket in the British Isles as a whole this week, Sid. Firstly, Ireland beat Pakistan 2-1 in their T20 series, a historic victory.
Yeah, and definitely some sort of positive green shoots for Ireland, I think. So they got absolutely tonked in the first two ODIs, and after the first two ODIs, we were looking at it going, oh, this is carnage. The third ODI, they came back, and I mean, Pakistan still won reasonably convincingly, but it wasn't the absolute hammering that the first two had been. And then in the T20 series, Ireland, you know, won two out of those three games and took home the series. And that's just a fantastic achievement, I think. If they won just one of those games, you go, oh, well, that, you know, they got lucky. That can happen in T20 cricket. T20 cricket is a leveller. But to win two of those games and to therefore take the series, I think, is an important marker for Ireland in terms of, you know, their self-belief. This is what they can achieve. You know, I still think that they're going to have a very hard time in the whole of the Women's International Championship Series over the next couple of years. You know, I'm afraid they're probably still going to lose more games than they're going to win. But, you know, it's a positive sign that they can compete at that level. And, you know, that's exactly what they needed at this early stage in the Championship Series. Yes, the actual championship points, they've got none, and Pakistan have got six. But they've shown that they can, you know, come face to face with Pakistan, and that should give them hope they're going to be able to come face to face with some of the other teams and, you know, challenge them and get some results on the board.
Yeah, and perhaps the early fruits of professionalism and more investment in that side. Talking of which, the other piece of good news I was referring to is that the Scotland women's team are getting paid contracts for the first time, Cricket Scotland have announced, and that is very exciting news.
Yeah, I mean, the key here is that we don't really know anything other than the headline, do we? There's been no real information apart from to say that they are going to have some paid contracts.
I think they're going to be 10.
The $64,000 question is, you know, what they're going to be worth. Will they be enough to persuade the likes of the Bryce sisters and Abta Maqsood to come back to Scotland, where they're currently playing professionally in England? Would that even be a good idea, Raf? You know, given that the setup in England that the Bryces and Abta Maqsood are able to take advantage of in terms of being part of those much more fully professional setups. Would it be a good idea?
Yeah, well, obviously, what you've got if you're a regionally contracted player is you're a member of the PCA. You've therefore got access to lots of kind of really good medical insurance and medical facilities, you know, full like physios and those kind of more those other aspects to the setups than just being paid to play, and obviously Cricket Scotland perhaps might struggle to match some of those offerings, given that it's a relatively speaking a smaller setup up there. So it's possible that those players might decide that they're going to stay in England. It also means that the professional contracts or the paid contracts that do come up can go to other players, and then you extend your professional player pool more than if you had those three come back up and be professionals in Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that the kind of one of the positives of being down here is you get a lot more competitive cricket than you'll get up in Scotland. But the negative from Scotland's perspective is that if their best players are continuing to play in England, that means that the cricket played by the rest of those players in Scotland is less competitive. So that's a really interesting dilemma for Scotland. If they bring those players back and say, come back here, you know, we'll pay you an equivalent rate, we'll make it worth your while, you can be part of the Scottish system, those players won't get as competitive a cricket, but everyone else in Scotland, the level of cricket that they're getting will go up.
It is a dilemma,
so
isn't it?
It's a difficult one, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's really interesting that they've said that Cricket Scotland have actually said in the press release this is a start to putting the women's game onto a fully professional footing, because they clearly recognise that this is just the first of many steps that still need to come. So I would imagine that what they would ultimately want is for players like the Bryce sisters to be playing back up in Scotland and to be doing that on a full-time basis. But perhaps in the immediate future, that's not realistic or feasible. And so what they're trying to do is just say, OK, we want to be competitive. And that's the key to this, ultimately, is that Scotland know that if they don't start to pay their women's players, they're just going to fall further and further behind. You know, once upon a time, Scotland and Ireland and England played each other in the European Championship, and it was vaguely competitive. England have now left both of those countries kind of far behind in terms of the professionalism of their setup. But actually, Ireland are starting to be more professional as well. And so Scotland are potentially going to get left behind by Ireland. And what we see is that, you know, Scotland women have still never been in a World Cup. And they are, you know, usually they win the European qualifier and they then go to the qualifying tournament for multiple World Cups. They're also in the qualifying tournament for the Commonwealth Games. That would have been really exciting for them if they had managed to win that. But they can't then produce the results against sides which have more investment.
Yeah, they're a long way from being able to get into that kind of top couple of slots, aren't they, in terms of these qualifiers?
Yeah.
And you were talking about this on BBC Scotland, weren't you? Because they were asking you, you know, what are the positives for Scotland here? What does Scotland gain out of this? What ultimately they're hoping to get for Scotland?
Yeah, well, they want to... I mean, in a way, what they want is to replicate some of the amazing results that the men's team has pulled off. There was that fantastic victory against England a few years ago that's still kind of widely celebrated. You know, though it's those kind of
You're
results.
Referring to the Battle of Culloden there.
Something like that, Sid. The cricketing equivalent. You know, they want their women's team to be able to compete in the way that the men's team can. You know, and to move in that general direction. So yeah, I think it's a really exciting step. There's a long way to go, but at least they acknowledge that that's the direction they need to head in.
Awesome.
And on that note, actually, I did tweet saying that we should have an England v Scotland v Ireland tri-series. How amazing would that be? Maybe in a couple of years when Ireland and Scotland have had a little bit more time to kind of establish their professional setup. But as UK Crunch pointed out, it would be very low carbon, so it would fulfil all of those sustainability agendas.
Yeah, I think it's something that definitely feels doable. I mean, you know, England obviously have already started to kind of break out their T20 team from their ODI team. Mm. So you could say, well, this is going to be for the T20 team. You know, you would be able to potentially have a slightly different team, a team that will perhaps give Ireland and Scotland a little bit more of a crack at having an opportunity to win the game against England. But even so, I think it's important for them to come and play those games because they'll get an idea of what it's going to be really like at the very highest levels. You could play it across like 3 or 4 days at a single venue.
Yeah.
A bit like we did a tri-series in the reasonably recent past at Taunton with South Africa and
New Zealand.
It was a great few days in Taunton. Something like that, you know, I'm sure would get the spectators excited and, you know, could get plenty of people to come and watch at one of the smaller grounds. It could be a great way to spend a weekend at, you know, Derby or wherever.
Derby? Why did you pick Derby?
Well,
anywhere but Derby and I'd be there anyway. And finally this week, we've had some more news from the ICC working group on Afghanistan, who again do not appear to be working. Apparently the Afghanistan government have agreed, in principle, in inverted commas, to support women's cricket. Do the Taliban have principles, Sid? Are the ICC really stupid enough to think that the Taliban have principles? Every signal that we've seen coming out of Afghanistan since this working group was set up and since I had my previous rant about their non-working of this working group, every signal that we've had is that women are being treated horrendously under the Taliban and that all of their opportunities to exercise are being completely shut down. And I can't believe that the people in this working group actually accept that it's a possibility that women's cricket will resume in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be quite credulous. You know, the regime in Afghanistan, for instance, have consistently told the United Nations that they're going to reopen education to women because the United Nations funds a lot of their education. So the Taliban have said, yeah, don't worry, guys, we're going to reopen education. discrimination to women hasn't happened, and yet somehow the ICC are going, yeah, sure, we totally take at face value your promise to support women's cricket in some way, in a week, ironically, when the Taliban have closed down a load of women's only sports facilities in the capital. You know, we saw pictures only in the last week or so of, you know, women going to their sports facilities, women only facilities that have been open, you know, throughout the first year of the Taliban's kind of new regime, and they've now been closed as well. So you believe that? Well, guys, I've got a bridge to sell you.
Yeah, as I said on Twitter, it's just basically a male talking shop to justify complete lack of action.
Yeah, I mean,
on women's cricket, and to justify them breaking
their own rule. We don't believe that they actually believe this, do we?
It's to justify them breaking their own rule with regard to the fact that you aren't allowed to be an ICC full member unless you have a women's team. So, yeah, I suppose from that perspective, it's working for the men. So, well done, guys. But I'm disgusted by it, frankly. Should we wrap up there, Sid?
Yeah.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. See you in a week's time.
Bye.